Lost Souls Radio.
Most people are now confronting the most important issues of the millennium: life and death. Yet who is shaping the discourse? Generals, corporate executives, and government officials.
We're a compassionate deafening
silence, but people cannot take action around the issues and the people that matter most. People are now confronting the most important issues of the millennium.
We're a compassionate
peace. Life
people
and death
take action.
Yet who is shaping the discourse?
Generals,
corporate executives,
but
and government
cannot
officials.
Take action
because of the deafening silence.
In a media landscape where there are more
the
channels
and
than ever,
that lack of any diversity of opinion confronting the most important issues of the millennium.
In a media landscape where there are more channels than ever,
death.
The lack
of who is shaping the discourse?
People cannot
generals, corporate executives,
and government
officials
because of the deafening silence
in the mainstream media around the issues and the people that matter most.
And people are now confronting the most important issues of the millennium.
The lack of peace, diversity,
life and death.
Yet who is shaping the discourse?
Generals, corporate executives,
and government officials.
The people who have had
the lesson
information from Vietnam.
A lesson in manipulation.
In Iraq, there would be no daily television images of the human toll of war.
The government and the media would portray a clean war. A war nearly devoid of victims.
And imagine
you control the images
and
you control the people.
Hellish.
The lesson had been learned from
even
the
one week.
A lesson.
What impact would that have?
In
I
Iraq,
think we would be able to abolish
it.
And imagine if the U.S.
media showed uncensored,
hellish images
of war,
even for one week.
What impact would that have?
I think we would be able to abolish
control.
I imagine being
U.S. media
showed uncensored,
hellish
images of war, even for one week.
Even for one week.
What impact would that have?
I think we would be able to abolish control.
And imagine if the U.S. media showed
uncensored,
images of war,
even for one week.
What impact would that have?
I think we would be able to abolish war.
These are the voices that shape movements.
Movements
that make history.
These are people who change the world
just as much as generals, bankers, and politicians.
They are the mainstream,
yet they are ignored by the mainstream media.
These are the voices
that shape
by the mainstream media.
They make
history. The mainstream.
These are
yet
people
who change the world
by the
just as
media.
Much as generals,
they are
bankers, and politicians.
Yet they are ignored
they are the
by
mainstream media. They are ignored
by the mainstream media.
They are ignored
by the mainstream
media. That shape
Americans.
And then came the mainstream media to manufacture consent to sell to Chomsky and then came the mainstream media to manufacture consent to sell to Chomsky and then came the mainstream media to manufacture consent to sell to Chomsky and then came the mainstream media to manufacture consent to sell to Chomsky and then came the mainstream media to manufacture consent to sell to Chomsky and then came the mainstream media to manufacture consent to sell to Chomsky and then came the mainstream media to manufacture consent to sell to Chomsky and then came the mainstream media to manufacture consent to sell to Chomsky and then came the mainstream media to manufacture consent to sell to Chomsky and then came the mainstream media to manufacture consent to sell to Chomsky and then came the mainstream media to manufacture consent to sell to Chomsky and then came the mainstream media to manufacture consent to sell to Chomsky and then came the mainstream media to manufacture consent to sell to Chomsky and then came the mainstream media to manufacture consent to sell to Chomsky and then came the mainstream media to manufacture consent to sell to Chomsky and then came the mainstream media to manufacture consent to sell to Chom of a journalist, giving a voice to those who have been forgotten, forsaken,
going to win down by the powerful.
That's the responsibility.
It's the best reason I know to carry our cameras, and microphones
into our own communities
and out to the wider in the silence.
Going to where the silence
is. That's the responsibility.
Going to where the silence is.
Giving a voice to those who have been forgotten,
forsaken, and beaten down by the powerful.
It's the best reason I know to carry our cameras,
and microphones
into our own communities
and out to the wider world.
Explaining the world we see around us.
We're a cross-section of races, ethnicities, social classes.
Explaining the world we see around us.
You can surf
we're
through hundreds
of channels
races
before you realize there's nothing
social
on TV.
Classes.
You can surf through hundreds of channels before you realize there's nothing on TV.
You can surf through hundreds of channels before you realize there's nothing on TV.
You can surf through hundreds of channels before you realize there's nothing on TV.
You can surf through hundreds of channels
before you realize there's nothing on TV.
There's nothing on TV.
Celebrated historians. His classic work, A People's History of the United States, changed the way we look at history in this country. First published a quarter of a century ago, the book has sold over 1 million copies and is a phenomenon in the world of publishing, selling more copies each successive year. After serving as a bombardier in World War II, Howard Zinn went on to become a lifelong dissident and peace activist. He was active in the civil rights movement and many of the struggles for social justice over the past 40 years. He taught at Spelman College, the historically black college for women, and was fired for insubordination for standing up for the students. He was recently invited back to give the commencement address. Howard Zinn has written numerous books and is professor emeritus at Boston University. He recently spoke in Madison, Wisconsin, where he was receiving the Haven Center's Award for Lifetime Contribution to Critical Scholarship. We bring you his lecture, The Uses of History and the War on Terrorism.
Do you get the feeling sometime that you're living in an occupied country? That's very often a feeling I get when I wake up in the morning and I think, I'm living in an occupied country. A small group of aliens have taken over the country and trying to do with it what they will. We really are how they are alien to me. And those people who are coming across the border from Mexico, they are not alien to me, you see. Muslims who come to this country to live, they are not alien to me, you see. These demonstrations, these wonderful demonstrations that we have seen very recently on behalf of immigrant rights, and you've seen those signs saying, no human being is alien. I think that's true, except for the people in Washington. You see, they've taken over the country, they've taken over the policy, they've driven us into two disastrous wars, disastrous for our country, and even more disastrous for the people in the Middle East. They have sucked up the wealth of this country and given it to the rich and given it to the multinationals, given it to Halliburton, given it to the makers of weapons. They're ruining the environment and they're holding on to 10,000 nuclear weapons while they want us to worry about the fact that Iran may, in 10 years, get one nuclear weapon, you see.
From listening to records,
how mad can you be?
Did pretty well, except there were a few mistakes. But
the question is, how this been allowed to happen? How have they gotten away with it? They're not following the will of the people. They manufactured a will of the people for a very short time, right after the war started, as governments are able to do right after the beginning of an armed conflict. You know, they're able to create an atmosphere of war hysteria. And so for a short time, they captivated the minds of the American people. That's not true anymore. The American people have begun to understand what is going on and have turned against the policies in Washington. But of course, they are still there. They are still in power. The question is, how do they get away with it? In trying to answer this question, I looked a little at the history of Nazi Germany. No, it's not that we are Nazi Germany, but you can learn lessons from everybody and from anybody's history. In this case, I was interested in the ideas of Hermann Göring, who you may know was second in command to Hitler, head of the Luftwaffe, and at the end of World War II, when the Nazi leaders were put on trial in Nuremberg, Hermann Göring was in prison along with other of the leaders of the Nazi regime. And he was visited in prison by a psychologist who was given the job of interviewing the defendants at Nuremberg. And the psychologist took notes, and in fact, a couple of years after the war, wrote a book called Nuremberg Diary, in which he recorded, put his notes in that book. And he recorded his conversation with Hermann Göring. And he asked Göring, how come that Hitler, the Nazis, were able to get the German people to go along with such absurd and ruinous policies of war and aggression. And I happen to have those notes with me. We always say, we happen to have these things. just here by chance. Goering said, why, of course. The people don't want war. Why would some poor slob on a farm want to risk his life in a war? But after all, it is the leaders in the country who determine the policy. The people can always be brought to the bidding of the leaders. All you have to do is tell them they're being attacked and denounce the pacifists for lack of patriotism. It works the same way in any country. I was interested in that last line. It works the same way in any country. I mean, here, this, these are the Nazis. That's the fascist regime. We are democracy. But it works the same way in any country. Whatever you call yourself, whether you call yourself a totalitarian state or you call yourself a democracy, it works the same way. And that is the leaders of the country are able to cajole or coerce and entice the people into war by scaring them, telling them they're in danger, and threatening them and coercing them that if they don't go along, they will be considered unpatriotic. And this is what really happened in this country right after 9/11. And this is what happened right after Bush raised the specter of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq and got for a while the American people to go along with this. But the question is, how did they get away with it? What about the press? What about the media? Isn't it the job of the press? Isn't it the job of the media? Isn't it the job of journalism to expose what governments do? Don't journalists learn from I.F. Stone, who said, you know, just remember two words, he said to the young people who were studying journalism. He said, just remember two words, governments lie. Well, but the media have not picked up on that. The media have gone along. And they embraced the idea of weapons of mass destruction. You remember when Colin Powell appeared before the United Nations just before the onset of the Iraq War and laid out to the UN this litany of weaponry that Iraq possessed, according to him, and gave great details and how many canisters of this and how many tons of this and so on and so forth. And the next day, the press was just aglow with praise. They didn't do their job of questioning. They didn't job of asking, what is your evidence? Where did you get this intelligence? Who did you talk to? What are your sources? Isn't this what you learn as a freshman in college? Hey, what are your sources? Where are your footnotes? No, they were just, the Washington Post said, it is hard to imagine how anyone could doubt that Iraq possesses weapons of mass destruction. And the New York Times, you know, was just beside themselves with admiration for Colin Powell. Of course, it all turned out to be untrue, all turned out to be lies, but the press did not do its job. And as a result, the American people watching television, reading the newspapers, had no alternative source of information, no alternative opinion, no alternative critical analysis of what was going on. And the question is, why still did the people believe what they read in the press? Why did they believe what they saw on television? And I would argue that it has something to do with the loss of history. It has something to do with what Studs Terkel called national amnesia. Either the forgetting of history or the learning of bad history. The learning of that, the kind of history that you do get of Columbus was a hero, and Teddy Roosevelt is a hero, and Andrew Jackson is a hero, and all these guys who were presidents and generals and industrialists and so on, they had a great thing, the people who made America great. And America's always done good things in the world, and we always had our little problems, of course. Lots of slavery, for instance, you know, but we overcome them, you know, and, you know, not that kind of history. If the American people really knew history, if they learned history, if the educational institutions did their job, if the press did its job in giving people historical perspective, then people would understand. When the president gets up before the microphone and says, we must go to war for this or for that, for liberty or for democracy, or because we're in danger and so on, if people had some history behind them, they would know how many times presidents have announced to the nation, we must go to war for this reason or that reason. They would know that President Polk said, oh, we must go to war against Mexico because, well, there was an incident that took place on the border there, and we, you know, our honor demands that we go to war. They would know, if they knew some history, how the, you know, President McKinley took the nation into war against Spain and Cuba, saying, well, we're going in to liberate the Cubans from Spanish control. And in fact, there's a little bit of truth to that. We did go in, we fought against Spain, we got Spain out of Cuba, we liberated them from Spain, but not from ourselves. And so Spain was out, and United Fruit was in. And then the American banks, the American corporations were in. And if people knew their history, they would know, you know, that President McKinley said, as the American army was already in the Philippines and the American Navy was already in the Philippines, and Theodore Roosevelt, one of our great presidential heroes, was lusting for war, then people would know that McKinley, who did not know where the Philippines were. But very often our presidents need to be briefed and told where something is. You know, George Bush, this is where Iraq is. You know, Lyndon Johnson, this is where the Gulf of Tonkin is. You know, they need it. President, they would know if they knew the history, that President Kennedy said, we're going into the Philippines to civilize and Christianize the Filipinos. And if they knew their history, if the history books spent some time on the war in the Philippines in the early part of the 20th century, instead of, as history books do, they spent a lot of time on the Spanish-American War, which just lasted 3 months. They spent virtually no time on the war in the Philippines, a bloody war which lasted, 7 years. And which involved massacres and the extermination of populations, that history doesn't appear. We civilized and Christianized the Filipinos and established our control. They would know if they heard the president say, we're going to bring democracy to the Middle East. They would know how many times we brought democracy to other countries that we invaded. They would know if we brought democracy to Chile when we overthrew a democratically elected government in Chile in 1973. They would know how we brought democracy to Guatemala when we overthrew, a democratically elected. Oh, we love democratic elections. We love free elections, except when they go the wrong way. And then we send either our army in or the CIA in or a secret agents in to overthrow the government. If people knew that history, they would never for a moment believe President Bush when he says, we're going into Iraq, you know, because of this reason and that reason, and liberty and democracy and their threat. It takes some historical understanding to be skeptical of the things that authorities tell you. When you know history, you know that governments lie, as I.F. Stone said. Governments lie all the time. Oh, not just the American government. It's just in the nature of governments. Well, they have to lie. I mean, governments in general do not represent the people and the societies that they govern. And since they don't represent the people, and so since they act against the interests of the people, the only way they can hold power is if they lie to the people. If they told people the truth, they wouldn't last very long. But history can help in understanding deception and being skeptical. You're not rushing to embrace whatever the government tells you. But if you know some history, you would understand something which is even more basic, perhaps, than the question of lying about this war, or lying about this invasion, or lying about this intervention. Something more basic, if you know some history, you would understand a sort of fundamental fact about society, and including our society, that the interests of the government and the interests of the people are not the same. It's very important to know this, because the culture tries very hard to persuade us that we all have a common interest. They use the language, national interest. There's no national interest. There's their interest and our interest. National security. Who's secure? National defense. Whose defense? All these words and phrases are used to try to encircle us all into a nice big bond, so that we will assume that the people who are the leaders of our country have our interests at heart. And very important to understand, no, they do not have our interests at heart. You will hear a young fellow who is going off to Iraq. I remember doing the same thing when the young fellow went off to Vietnam. And a reporter goes up to the young fellow and says, young man, you're going off, and what are your thoughts, and why are you doing this? The young man says, I'm doing this for my country. No, he's not doing it for his country. And now she's not doing it for her country. People go, well, I'm not fighting for their country. They're not doing their country any good. They're not doing their families any good. They're certainly not doing the people over there any good. But they're not doing it for their country. They're doing it for their government. They're doing it for Bush. That would be a more accurate thing to say. I'm going off to fight for George Bush. I'm going off to fight for Cheney. I'm going off to fight for Rumsfeld. I'm going off to fight for Halliburton. That would be telling the truth.
Historian Howard Zinn speaking in Madison, Wisconsin. We'll come back to his address in a minute.
Lossell's Radio.
Peace. Quiet.
instinct we inherited from our hunting.
Is making war an instinct we inherited from our hunting or farming ancestors? Were farmers the first warriors? Were farmers the first warriors? Were farmers the first 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 warriors?
Do we love
without being king?
Do we love?
Do we love without being love?
Without being love?
Do we love without being love?
Do we love without thinking?
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 Without thinking?
Do we do the right thing?
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 Do we do the right thing without thinking?
Do we do the right thing?
Do we do the right thing
without thinking?
Do we do the right thing
without thinking?
Will children fight with their brothers and sisters? Are they learning how to make war?
Will children fight with their brothers and sisters? Are they learning how to make war?
As we return now to a recent address by legendary historian Howard Zinn, author of the classic work, A People's History of the United States. He recently spoke in Madison, Wisconsin, on the uses of history and the war on terrorism.
To know the history of this country is to know that we have had conflict of interest in this country from the beginning, very beginning, between the people in authority and the ordinary people. We are not one big happy family that fought the American Revolution against England. I remember, in school, that's how it seemed, they're the patriots. And there's all of us working, fighting together with at Valley Forge and Bunker Hill and so on against the Redcoats and the British and so on. It wasn't that way at all. It wasn't a united country. A very large part of the population did not believe in the war. Washington had to send generals down south to use violence against young people to force them into military service.
soldiers in the Revolutionary Army mutinied against Washington, against the officers, because there was class conflict in the army, just as there had been class conflict all through the colonies before the Revolutionary War. Well, anybody who knows the military, anybody who's been in the military, knows that the military is a class society. There are the privates and there are the officers. And in the Revolutionary War, the privates were not getting shoes and they were not getting clothes and not getting food and they were not getting paid. And the officers were living high and in resplendence. And so they mutinied, thousands of them. I don't remember ever learning about that when I studied history in school, because the myth comes down, oh, we're all one big happy family. You mean including the black slaves? You mean including the Native Americans, whose land we were taking from them mile by mile by mile by mile? We're all one big happy family. The women who are left out of all of this, very important to understand that fundamental fact. Those people who run the country and we, our interests are not the same. So, yes, history is useful for that, for understanding that we are a nation like other nations, for understanding that we are not, as again we are taught from early on, we are the greatest, we are number one, we are the best. What it's called American exceptionalism in the social sciences. The United States is an exception to the rule of nations. That is, the general rule of nations is that they're pretty bad. But the United Nations, the United States, our country, we are good. We do good in the world. Not long ago, I was on a radio program interviewed by, this is sort of a regular commercial station. I like to be interviewed on regular commercial stations where the guy really doesn't know who he's invited, you see. And he says, Professor Zinn, don't you think America has in general been a force for good in the world? No. No. Why not ask me, do you think the British Empire was a force for good in Africa? Or the Belgians were a force for good in the Congo? Or the French were a force for good in Indochina? Do you think the United States was a force for good when they sent the Marines into Central America again and again? No. But there's this notion of, we are different. We are the great. I mean, sure, there are very good things about America, but that's not what we did to other countries. Not what we did to black people. Not what we did to Native Americans. Not what we did to working people in this country who suffered 12-hour days until they organized and rebelled and rose up. We have to be honest with ourselves. This is a very hard thing to do. Be honest about ourselves. But you brought up and you say, I pledge of allegiance, et cetera, et cetera. Liberty and justice for all. God bless America. Why us? Why is God blessing us? I mean, why is he singling us out for blessing, why not God bless everybody? If indeed, we're brought up. If we were brought up to understand our history, we're like other nations, only more so. Because we are bigger and have more guns and more bombs and therefore are capable of more violence. We can do what other empires were not able to do to such an extent. We are rich. Well, not all of us. Some of us are.
you see. But, no, we have to be honest. No, don't people join Alcoholics Anonymous so that they can stand up and be honest about themselves? And maybe we ought to have an organization called Imperialists Anonymous. You know. Have the leaders of the country get up there on national television and say, well, it's time, you know, time to tell the truth. that would be, I don't really expect it to happen. But, you know, it would be refreshing. And then if we knew this history, we would understand how often fear has been used as a way of getting people to act against their own interests, to work up hysteria, and to get people to do terrible things to other people because they've been made afraid. Wasn't it fear and hysteria that motivated lynch mobs in the South? Wasn't there created fear of black people, hysteria about black people that led white people to do some of the most atrocious things that have been done in our history? Fear of Muslims, not just terrorists in general. Of course, fear of terrorists, but especially fear of Muslims, you see. A very ugly kind of sentiment to inculcate in the American people. Creating a kind of hysteria which then enables them to control the population and enable them to send us into war after war and to threaten, you know, still another war. But if we knew some history, we would know about the hysteria that accompanied the Cold War, the hysteria about communism. It's not that communism didn't exist, just as terrorism does exist, yes. It's not that communism existed, and there was a Soviet Union, and it was repressive to its own people, and it did control Eastern Europe, but there was an enormous exaggeration of the Soviet threat to the point where, it's not just that they're in Eastern Europe. They're going to invade Western Europe. By the way, no evidence of that. CIA analysts who were specialists in the Soviet Union in recent years came forward and said there was never any evidence that the Soviet Union were going to invade Western Europe. But against that, NATO was created. Against that, the United States built up an enormous nuclear arsenal. The Soviets were always behind the United States. They built up the Soviets as a threat, but after all, who had the atom bomb first? And who had more atom bombs than anybody? And who was the only country that actually dropped atomic bombs on ordinary people in two cities in Japan? And so we, who use the atomic bomb, we who accumulate the atomic bomb, we create a hysteria about countries that are desperately trying to catch